Hello, I'm talking with Ethelia Ruiz Medrano, and she is in her home in Mexico, and I'm in Mississippi, so this is kind of an exciting conversation. Ethelia is the author of Mexico's Indigenous Communities, Their Lands and Histories, 1500 to 2010, and it's published by the University Press of Colorado. Hello, Ethelia, we're glad you're here.
Oh, well, I'm glad to be here. Thank you so much, Jenny, for this wonderful conversation that I'm having with you.
I know. I'm so excited. We haven't talked in a long time, and it's great to have you live. Will you tell me a little bit about your background? Tell me about your family and how you got involved in the study of what you study.
In Mexico, every way you look at, you find indigenous people. And as Mexicans, we are also indigenous descendants. Though there's a common place that we are like a mestizo country, but that depends. If you're talking in a cultural way, we are mestizos. But if you're talking in a biological way, I mean, most of the Mexican population, we are Indians. Our grandfathers, our grandmothers, aunts, everybody is, from one or two or maybe three indigenous communities from all over the country. So for me, it was easy to start working with indigenous people. I really wanted to know more about them. And ever since I was little, my dad used to take us to a small town churches and talk to us about cultural representations made by the indigenous people and all the things they made and how wonderful they were and all the archaeology and everything. So, you know, it was clear for me that I wanted to study history since I was a bachelor. And then since 25 years ago when I started my PhD, God, that was a long time ago, I decided to focus on indigenous communities. First, because that's the way life was with me, I had the opportunity to do a PhD in Spain, basically in the University of Sevilla. So I had the opportunity to work for 5 years in the National Archive of Indias, which is the most important administrative archive. So for my PhD, I had a very good idea of how this big bureaucratical machine work, that is the administration of the Spanish Kingdom of Castilla all over Latin America. And then my professor, he was a specialist in Peru. So I read a lot of things about Peru, and I had the opportunity of having a semester, being a student for a semester with John Mura, who was in Sevilla. And that really changed my way of seeing things and everything. I really admire very much his work. And so I started working on how the colonial system tried to integrate the indigenous people. Because usually we have two ways of seeing indigenous society. Either indigenous people after the conquest, you know, they are always rebelling themselves and resisting all the time, which I believe it's quite tiring for them. And I don't think it is like that at all. Or you have this point of view like they were just, you know, like the sad Indians, poor things. Small birds, all broken their wings and just, you know, things coming over them without them doing anything to stop them. So I start seeing when I work for my thesis that it was neither one of these things, that the indigenous people, through their authorities and themselves, did a lot of negotiation with the colonial state. They move around. They move pretty well. They learn pretty well how the system worked. They shape the system towards their interests since they were the vassals of the crown. So they took advantage of this. And then I started seeing that it was necessary to go ahead and see how they work in 17th, 18th century. And then, well, you know, like 7 years ago, I thought, well, maybe it's time to move forward and see if they kept negotiating with the national state in the 19th and 20th century after the Mexican Revolution. And so I started like my own, I don't know how you can call it, like I start reading about this and looking in the archives and trying to manage one line of argumentation, which was how do indigenous people search for their history as a political weapon to negotiate with the colonial state and with the national state. And, well, 7 years ago, I thought, well, I think it's the time to go and look for some indigenous community who really are very much interested in their history and see if they can work with me and I can work with them and, you know, just exchange knowledges. And, well, I was lucky enough. I found Santa Maria Cuquila in the High Mixtec. It took me a long time to find them because none of my anthropologist friends wanted to take me to the field. They are very jealous about their...
No historians allowed.
Just keep out. You know, I'm stubborn. So I found a friend of ours, an anthropologist, who really wanted to know how to work on an archive, that it's a local archive in the High Mixtec.
Oh, wow.
And she said, okay, let's do some exchange. I'm very Indian in that.
Mm-hmm. Good for you.
I like to exchange.
To barter,
things.
Yeah, negotiate.
Yeah, you give me this, I give you that,
yeah,
okay?
There you go.
And we move forward.
Mm-hmm.
So I told her, okay, I'll go with you to this local archive, which you want to know how to work on. And you take me to your indigenous community where you work. So we did she took me to the High Mixtec, which is around 10 hours drive from Mexico City. I've never been there.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this wonderful archive. It used to have a lot of documentation from the colonial period, but it was, you know, it was destroyed because nobody cared about this documentation anymore.
Wow.
And it was in the city of Tlaxiaco.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, Ronald Spores, who is one of the greatest, you know, archaeologists and ethnohistorians of the High Mixtec, he managed to have a sort of agreement with the University of Vanderbilt, where he was working. And so he saved the archive, also with Professor John Monahan.
Oh.
Yeah, John Monahan, who is, I think, the best ethnologist of the High Mixtec, I believe that even of Oaxaca.
Wow.
And he's a professor at the University of Chicago, Illinois. And both of them saved the archive, but the colonial part was lost.
Mm-hmm.
And but it had a lot of documentation about 19th century, very local history of this remote towns that nobody care about, that have a deep history and are incredibly rich in traditions and culture and everything. So I started working with her, taught her how to move in the archive. And then she said, okay, is it time to take you to the community where I work, which is, it's not Santa Maria Cuquila, it's another community. But the problem is that this community had a lot of land conflicts.
Oh.
And there was some shooting and everything, and it was in the news. And, well, I said to my friend, she is a French anthropologist, Esther Katz, I told her, well, you know, I'm not really trained in this, so, and you really look like a gringo or an American. So I don't think it's a good idea to go with you, you know. And she said, oh, nothing will happen. I'll go by myself. And I say, okay, I'll stay in the archive a couple of days and then I'll go back to Mexico. And I was sad because I say, okay, I'm a coward. But, you know, Aurora, my daughter, was only 1 year old. So I thought, well, I better, you know, live a little bit more. And there I was in the archive when the director of the archive said, you have a lot of codices, that is native manuscript painting, in your computer. I wonder if you have some from this region, from the High Mixtec. And I said, sure, this, like, look at this one. was a 16th century map, and he say, "Oh, that's from the town of Santa Maria Cuquila. It's a beautiful town. It's very near from here. Why don't we go?" And they have a community museum, which is a very interesting thing that many indigenous communities have in Oaxaca. They have community museums.
Right.
And so I say, great, let's go. So I went there. There was this community museum full of part of the history. This town has 2,000 years of history.
Wow.
They have never been congregated or very little. So they have an enormous archaeological site that nobody works on, and that it's almost the size of Monte Albán.
Wow.
They have a beautiful 17th century church, and everybody speaks Mixtec and Spanish. And of course, some of them even speak English because they have migrated and come back from the United States.
Wow.
So I was there, and then I saw in the museum some 16th century documentation that they kept there. And I was looking at it through the glasses that they have, and, you know, like a small furniture with where they keep them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at this documentation, and then the person in charge of the museum, because everybody takes, you know, they are all authorities and all the committee for the small health center, the schools,
mm-hmm.
everything. It's community thing. Policemen, everything. And they do it as a service for the community, even the high authorities. Nobody charges. They serve for a year or even for 3 years, and they do it on their own. You know, they have to do it because it's for the good of the community. So they are very united, and they are very proud of it. So there was this peasant who now is my compadre. And he said, Don Emiliano Melchor, and he said, "Can you read this?" And I said, "Yeah, sure. Why?" He said, "Oh, we wanted to know what it says. We think it says something about our lands, and we really like to know what it says." And I said, "But nobody has read it to you?" And he said, no, nobody. And I say, "Oh, sure, I can read them for you." And then, you know, in a moment, the museum was locked. I was stuck in it. It was a lot of people, children and women and men were surrounding me. And I was, you know, with my computer transcribing the document for the next 10 hours.
Wow.
Yeah, for them, because they really wanted it. And I mean, you just can't say no.
Sure.
They know how to convince you.
Right.
So... they were happy with this. We took it to the small town of Tlaxiaco, where the archive is and where I was working. And we printed out everything because the director of the archive was still waiting for me at 11 o'clock, you know, p.m.
Wow.
And we printed the document, and then I signed it because I said, maybe it has, you know, some legal interest for you because it is transcribed by a professional historian, so maybe you can use it for something.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very happy, and I thought, well, that will be it. But no, the next day they came with the authorities, and they say, "Well, we want you to come to our town whenever you are around here, and yeah, let's be friends." And all I said, right. "Great!" So I start searching for their documentation. It turned out, you know, that they had a lot of colonial documentation in their national archive, also in the agrarian archives.
Wow.
They had manuscript paintings from the 16th century in their national archive. And then they had a very rich history. So I started working with them. And then I started learning Mixtec with them, you know. And, well, now I do some, help them with some projects they try to do, because from the museum, all the relationship with, it's not only about history, but it's also about getting organized for doing this, you know, doing things that can bring some future for themselves. Small things, because I'm just a researcher, I can't do much. But we have started many projects that are in a web page that is called Comunidades Indígenas en Movimiento.
We'll put that in the blog, too, so that anybody that's interested can go visit.
Yeah, and we have there, thank you, Jenny, and we have there some productive projects. So I work with them at a level of ethnohistory and also doing field work. And then I started working with other communities, you know, that have a huge amount of history. Most of the region has more than 2,000 years of history recorded in stelas and in archaeological sites and in painted manuscripts, some of them even kept in the communities. And, well, the local archives are very rich and hardly known. And so, well, that's what I've been doing. So the book is more about the general idea and more than 200 cases of indigenous communities in from central Mexico and Oaxaca doing the legal recuperation of their history as a political tool. And the last chapter is an ethnology chapter about this community trying to recuperate his history, because with that they can gain hope for the future, you know. That's it.
it's fascinating. It's a fascinating read. And I'm so excited because it really shows, first of all, how we need to collaborate. Think of how hard those anthropologists worked to get in those communities, and you were adopted immediately.
Well, yeah, the thing is that they wanted something from me, and right. I wanted to be in it, you know, to be friends with them. So
it's about sharing and collaborating. Exactly. I think that's fascinating. I did have a professor that told us, the whole class one time, that there are hundreds or maybe thousands of little churches in Mexico with all these documents and all this information, and they're there, and you have to do your homework, but there's amazing things to be found. So,
oh yes, and very amazing things. It's just that what we have to do as researchers and university professors is try to open our heart and our mind,
exactly,
and do more exchange. One of the professors that I admire more because they work like this, and that I really love his work, it's an example for me, is Professor Frank Salomon,
right,
who works in Peru, and also Professor Thomas Abercrombie from NYU. He works in Bolivia. But both of them, you know, do a lot of exchange and friendship with indigenous communities and have found amazing things, especially Professor Frank Salomon. I believe he's one of the most important ethnohistorians in the world.
He worked with the Huarochirí, right? Is that him?
He works in projects in the in the Peruvian region of Huarochirí. Mm-hmm. He wrote the...
Right.
He did the Huarochirí manuscript.
Exactly.
And then he started doing research with ethnographical tools and exchange. And he has a beautiful book about the core keepers. He found...
That's right.
He found this beautiful quipus in a community. And if he had been there like 40 years before, he would have still found people who knew how to read them. But anyway, there's a lot of ritual and organization and exchange around this court, this quipus. And he did a beautiful book that has to do with the history of writing and also with the history of recording and also work of history and ethnology. And now he's working in a high place, 4,000 meters above the sea, that is called Rapaz. They have a quipu house and an archaeological site that has to do with the quipus also.
Wow.
And he's working with Andine, Quechua restorers and with the Quechua women of this community, restoring the quipus also.
Oh, man. And,
no, you have to see his page. It's, I can send it to you so that you can put it in the blog. Because
okay.
It's beautiful.
We'll do that.
Great. I'll send it, you know, to your email right away.
Perfect.
And he's a professor at the University of Wisconsin. And last year he was also, I invited him to come here and took him to Coquila.
Oh.
He just loved the town because he said that he was very much interested that all the political assemblies were made in Mixtec.
Mm-hmm.
And that this kind of assemblies in traditional languages, indigenous languages, were, well, a lot lost in Peru.
Mm-hmm.
So he really liked Coquila, and he gave me very, very good tips about how to work there.
Oh, wonderful. Well, the Water TD is all about water rights, too, and water rights do come up in some of the manuscripts that you were looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about, well, let's go through, let's talk a little bit more about your book. You do start with pre-Hispanic constructions of legal issues and courts and how things were negotiated. And so you want to start at the beginning and kind of work through the whole idea of advocating for your position and how that worked in Mesoamerica?
Well, yeah, the idea is that since I had a lot of information about how the administrative structure worked towards the Indians, I knew that the justice system was very important and that it was created after the conquest around, you know, the very early, like 12 years after the conquest. They tried to do the administration from Castilla, the King of Spain and its council, tried to work some system to attract the Indians to this legal arena where they could resolve some of their problems. And to do so, they have to work with them in their own costumes, you know, like using pictographical material, indigenous languages, in which the friars were very much advanced. So it was kind of like, not a mixture, but, you know, Spaniards were used to working with the others and conquering other people. No, they did this with the Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
They did this with the Jews. They did this with the Canarian
right
population. And so why not with the indigenous people, you know? So, and the indigenous communities were used to negotiating because before the conquest, most of them had to negotiate with Mexico Tenochtitlan. Mm-hmm. And before that, with small kingdoms, they were always negotiating tribute and labor and moving, yep, from here, from there. So, you know, of course it was a terrible conquest and in a social and political and cultural way. But the indigenous people had enough strength to try to move forward and negotiate with these people. And so they did. So I start with this history about justice, you know, how the indigenous people have. We know that they have what we can call justice systems that were not unified. You know, you have them from different regions and it worked differently, but it was very hierarchical because indigenous communities had a lot of interest in hierarchy. And it's not that everybody is the same.
Right.
That is very important. The one who has the worth, the one who has the power, the one who has the knowledge. So they're very used to that. And, of course, Europeans were also used, mm-hmm, to this kind of very hierarchical social and political structure. So in that, as James Lockhart says, you know, there were some coincidences.
Right.
So I start, you know, working about this and then moving forward. And then because a complex context that I work in the book, I looked at, well, for the Spanish administration at the end of the 16th century, it was enough of experimentation.
Mm-hmm.
And that the indigenous people really had to go into the normal justice system, you know, Occidental way of thinking and things like that. And they wanted to control the friars who were, you know, some of them very much near the political interest of the indigenous, let's say, kings or, mm-hmm, I don't know, how could we say, rulers.
Yeah.
And also from the encomenderos, or the Spaniard conquerors, the first and the second generation. And so there was no space for the indigenous people to negotiate anymore, so it seems. So I started looking how the system kept working on the 17th and 18th century, and found out that the indigenous people open again the discussion about their history, because for them it was very important to prove that they were original people, but not only original people, but they had a rich history of land.
Right.
And that though in the 16th century, we have a lot of subjects that the indigenous people negotiate about. After the 17th century, the most important issue was the land. The land, because the land is where the ancestors are, where the sacred caves are, where the idols are, where the shrines are, where they eat, where the, you know, it's everything. It's them, and it's also the gods. Only the gods give the land. So it was a very important issue for them. And, of course, Spaniards, local Spaniards, were taking the land out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they start a negotiation with the saying, here is our history. They start showing lots of pictorial manuscripts, and also giving written records in many indigenous languages about their history, how they came 1,000 years before, let's say. Of course, the idea of time is different.
Mm-hmm.
So I start working on this also. It's the only, like, not much, but a little, you know, not theoretical, because I use a lot of what the sense of history is not is in non-Occidental cultures.
Right.
And it seems that if for Occidental people, history has to do with reading only.
Mm-hmm.
But for non-Occidentals, and especially for non-Occidentals in America's continent, it had to do with the five senses, with looking, smelling, also hearing. So it had to do with dancing, music, praying, incensaries, seeing, pictorial manuscripts. All of the five senses are integrated.
Feasts, festivals, mm-hmm. where they eat.
Yes.
They consume, right?
Yes, that's right. And so, and of course, history for them is not if, like, I ask you, Professor Jeannie Gillespie, please talk to me about your grandma and your grandpa.
Right.
And you can do it, you know, right away and not ask me, well, you can ask me, well, okay, I'll do it. But for indigenous people, it's not like that. You can't just sit down and say, okay, tell me about your ancestors, because they will stand up and say, you know, I got a lot of things to do. See you later.
Yeah.
So, no, for them, you know, history, their local history has to do with problems they have in the present.
Mm-hmm.
Pressures, which are a lot, mm-hmm. they have in the present. And so they take knowledge from the past. They can mold it. They can change it. It has not a unified narrative. It has many narratives. It depends upon the problem of the present that takes them by the hand to go to that takes them to the past.
Right.
And when they do that, it's because they need that this past can solve, or at least put on the negotiation table, their problems in the present,
mm-hmm.
and pushes them or takes them towards the future.
So we're talking about applied history as opposed to abstract in a book history.
And that's right. You said it beautifully. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they're very practical. You know, they're peasant societies. So they're very practical in that. They can change it. They can mold it.
Mm-hmm.
They can put it in in one language, in two languages. They can go to one office, to another office, to talk to one authority, to another authority, take all documentation and refunctionally, you know, make it new again and with different subjects.
They adapt it to the need.
That's right. Yeah. Totally.
One of the critiques that they always say about ancient cultures is that they can't, I mean, the whole idea of linear society versus circular society, that they couldn't see history in the present. And it's silly. That's a silly way to look at it. That's a really badly thought out plan.
Yeah. So that is, you know, what
they're adapting.
And that is the history about how more than almost 200 towns do this through the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th century. Mm-hmm. And right now. And I like to talk about local history instead of memory.
Right.
Because for me, memory is like what you eat the day before.
Right.
And history has to do with more deep sense.
Right.
And why does Italian or French or Spaniards have history, and why doesn't indigenous communities have history? What they talk about their past is more like memory.
Right.
And no, I think it's history. It's just exactly. That it's local history, you know? It's the way they build history.
Well, and they may not use a book to trigger the memory of it.
And that's right. That's right.
They use other things.
Yeah, like quipus in Peru or manuscript paintings in Mexico.
Or a song. Or a mountain.
That's right. Important hunting rituals, mm-hmm. or many things.
Yeah.
You just have to look at it and see how wonderful things they're doing about this. More and in a very strong way, you know. I try to build a history more about not defeated people.
Right.
But proud people who are, you know, doing their best. And not all of the communities have survived.
Right.
But the ones, at least in Mexico, that we have are the ones who could organize better and understand what their identity was about. And for them, relying on their rich culture. And these are the ones that survive.
Exactly. And it may change, but things still continue that are necessary for that culture. So they may forget stuff, but there's other stuff that they add and it changes depending on their needs.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So as you went through the different centuries, were you surprised at the consistency of the effort? I continue to be surprised that, you know, they're still there. Yeah. They're still doing it. It's still vibrant.
Yeah. Yeah, they're moving. And of course, especially because, you know, in Mexico, there is the general idea that the colonial period was terrible, which it was. But, you know, I found out that the most terrible part of history, you know, where the Indians were more denied, was in the 19th century.
Right.
By our national governments, liberal or conservatives, you know, they could fight all the time, one against each other. But they had one point in which they were, you know, they could agree. And that was that the Indians were the backwardness, that, you know, they were something that had to be, you know, just eliminated.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see that in the United States, you see that in Argentina. That's a tip that's happened in many 19th century places.
Yes, and Chile also.
Mm-hmm, right.
Yes,
right.
That's right. So it also happened in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And also, I was surprised that even though they have this, you know, moments, very crucial moments all through the five centuries, they kept moving on and learning how to do this.
Adapt to the new, whatever new twist the government chose.
Yeah, and adapting themselves and everything. And so that is really an impressive cultural, political achievement of humanity.
Sure. No, it's fascinating.
Yes, and, well, for me. And one thing that I was surprised, you know, and that has to do with the United States, is that before I started reading and going to the 19th century archives that I chosen for looking at these problems of indigenous recuperation of history and negotiating with it in political ways towards the national state, I thought, oh my God, I'm going to find 1,000 books about indigenous history in 19th and 20th century, especially in Mexico or in Spanish.
Right.
And, well, I found almost none.
Wow.
The best books about indigenous history of Mexico, at least, were written in English by American specialists.
Wow. So Prescott and those guys?
No. Prescott, you know, he was
copied
more...
everybody's stuff.
No, I don't know. That's a gossip, Jenny.
I'm sorry.
No, I don't know. No. Contemporary.
Ah.
Yes. Yeah.
I see.
Like, so the first historian who wrote about the indigenous participation in the great independent movement who focused on indigenous people was written in 2001, published by Stanford University Press by Professor Eric Van Jung.
Wow.
That is the first book and the last one.
Wow, that's crazy.
It is. And of course, this book was translated to Spanish because nobody worked on this.
Wow.
And we are still waiting for the great book that can talk to us about the indigenous participation in the revolutionary movement.
Well, it's even with Juarez in the middle of everything.
Yeah, because Juarez, you know, they always say in the biographies, he was born in Guelatao, which is in the high mountains of the Zapotec region. And then that's it. And goodbye. No more indigenous identity in him. You know, he's more like Abraham Lincoln or,
right.
You know,
we have a statue of him in New Orleans.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. There's a statue of Benito because he came to New Orleans when he escaped.
Of course. Oh, yeah. He had a lot of admiration to the United States because, of course, they were going through this kind of, you know, mm-hmm. independent process, too, and trying to consolidate a national state. So for him, it was very important, this as an example, you know.
But that surprises me that in the 19th century, such little attention is paid to that when it was such a rallying cry.
Well, you know, they pay attention to Benito Juarez as a political figure and a historical figure in a way, but not because he, not at his indigenous background or at his indigenous contemporaries.
Right.
They just pay attention to the figure like if it was just Mexican.
Right. Like you said, like Abraham Lincoln. Yeah.
Yeah. Something like that. A liberal political man, very intelligent. And well, it's, you know, they say, and I believe that he was our best president.
Mm-hmm.
Funny that he was indigenous, huh?
Not so funny. Not a surprise, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's go back to your book because that, go ahead, keep going.
No, just, you know, I just wanted to say that it's very, very little the interest we have in the Mexican Academy towards indigenous people. And it's getting more narrow every day. And it's difficult to understand why this is.
Well, let's talk about Santa Maria Coquila a little bit more. I want to talk about the idea that they are, of course, citizens of the 21st century, but there's this big idea that the indigenous communities before the conquest were this sort of utopian space. And then they're sort of disembodied after they just disappear. Like you said, there's some stuff in the early 16th century, but in the academic discourse, it doesn't occur anymore except the idea of the indigenous communities. But there's still different communities all over Mexico who are thriving, like you said, and or facing many issues too. We talked before we started recording about the Mixtecos that come to the United States. In Mississippi, our largest population of immigrants coming from Mexico come from the Mixteca Alta.
Mm-hmm.
So, but a lot of them, like Santa Maria Cuquila, are continuing the same arts and the same stories and the same, there's not this disappearance locally. And so I want to go back to what you were saying about the whole idea of local history and reconnecting or reintroducing the rest of the world to the idea of local history.
Mm-hmm.
So what's going on in Santa Maria Cuquila about that?
Well, like in many indigenous communities like Santa Maria Cuquila, what I've seen is a very dynamical way of integrating new things. You know, it's very interesting how ideological flexible indigenous people are.
Yes.
In that they are very oriental, mm-hmm. you know, like the Chinese and the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
They can integrate new things. And when their old things or traditional things, if you want to say it in more, you know, academical way,
okay.
are not useful, you know, when they are not working, you know, they are more like a problem that a thing that helps them.
Right.
They just leave it and take the new thing that it's useful, but they don't merge them. They mm-hmm. go like one way and the other, like moving one hand, like if you move your hand up and down with the other one, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So they just go on and on and on, ahead. And they have the traditional things that are very important, and they are integrating new things. But they are very clear that these new things don't overlap the old things,
mm-hmm.
you know? They go parallel.
Mm-hmm.
And when the new things are not working or the ancient things are not working, they change.
Right.
And keep the fundamental things. So it's very interesting when you see, for example, in the high Mixtec, people going to the highest places to use their cell phones to talk to, in Mixtec, of course, to talk to the family in Missouri or in Washington or in Mississippi. And arranging the future weddings of the families that are living there.
Wow. You know?
And everything in Mixtec, or when you see the kids, 15, 18-year-old kids in the Mixtec communities, that they are chatting in Mixtec.
Mm-hmm.
Or when you see them in the traditional dress.
You mean internet chatting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Internet chatting in Mixtec.
That's right. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
In Mixtec or in Zapotec mm-hmm. or in Fiki. And mm-hmm. Also when you see them in their traditional dresses and in their traditional ceremonies, and then suddenly somebody is, you know, taking some tape recording of the situation and then using a cell phone to talk to somebody in Mexico City in the great neighborhood of Nezahualcoyot, where mm-hmm. 2 million indigenous people live, you know, and recreating things. And they are very much interested in technology, for example. And they integrate it very well when they can get it, when mm-hmm. they can grab it, and use it for their own purposes. And also they are very proud of their traditional languages, their religion. So they are very dynamical in that way. And that is how Cuquilas, Cuquileños are doing, you know. They take this, they give this, they exchange this, you know, as a concept, as a political tool, as a cultural tool also. And yeah, all the time moving forward, you know, it's very, very much interesting.
That's fascinating.
Yes. And of course they are, you can see that these are very poor regions, but I can tell you, and I'm sure everybody knows, that Mexico is now in a very violent moment.
Right.
We are having a lot of violence, but I can tell you that I've been traveling and visiting not only Santa Maria Cuquila, of course, there are my best friends there, but I've seen a lot of indigenous communities these 7 years and talked to them, worked with them. And I can tell you that violence, it may sound, you know, like not true to you, well, not to you, but to many people. But I can tell you, I see no violence there, not inside their communities. Mm-hmm. They stick together. The social tissue is in very good health in traditional indigenous communities. And traditional not because they're backward or because they're not modern, but I mean the ones that are together, you know, around their authorities, moving towards together, you know, in a very interesting and very historical, deep community unity. And you see no violence there. There's no violence there. You can see violence in the mestizos, cities and towns. And of course, even when they have problems with mestizos who are into this violent movements, they stick together and they close their communities and defend themselves. And as they, you know, then they try to negotiate the state to look at them and send them some help. And sometimes the state just doesn't help them. So they stick together and do it. Like, for example, right now, some indigenous communities in Michoacán and in Chihuahua. And that's how they're moving on. So, yeah, I think the social tissue is in the indigenous community. And in that way, I believe that they are the future.
Right. Well, they have to take it themselves because there's no one else there. I mean, that's also part of it. That's interesting.
Yeah.
One of my friends was in a small town in Hidalgo, and they got electricity there, but there wasn't anybody to put up the poles. So they organized a work group, and they carried these poles, huge, humongous poles that were in a stack, up the mountain so that they could string the electricity so they could have it to their they just did it themselves. They said, okay, we'll take care of it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, in the high mix, they do the same. You know, they build, and it's beautiful because when you see them doing this work that is called generally tequio, the community work, I've seen them doing this work very late, very tired, especially the man, the woman bringing food, the children playing around, and I've seen them and hear them sing.
Yeah.
They do the community work. Singing, and it reminds me of what the indigenous chronicles and also the Spanish chronicles say about the way that the traditional work was made in the ancient pre-Hispanic Mexico, that they sang, that they dance, that they eat and everything. And I've seen that, you know, like a month ago in Cuquila, doing community work while singing, telling jokes, laughing, and then everybody stopping for lunch with huge, very beautiful and good tortillas and eating and laughing and children running around and everybody, you know. Yeah.
Wow. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's what I wanted to tell.
No, I have... Tengo ganas. I want to go there now. I want to come visit Cuquila.
Oh, great. So, you're just invited. Wonderful.
Good. Great. so tell me where you're going now. What's your new project?
Well, right now, the book, you know, it's a general history of negotiation, as I said, and the history as a political weapon. But in Central Mexico and in Oaxaca, right now, I only want to focus on the high mixtec and do again this kind of research of longue durée with history and ethnography, but focusing on the chiefdoms, what was the local power through five histories, the way this local power negotiate with the colonial state and with the national state.
Wow.
And what this local power, which survived because we have this lineages in the Mixtec region that were still in power in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And so it was very special the way that the Mixtec people saw their local authorities, the local lords, etc. seems that they have more in common to the Incas in this image of power than to the Mexicas. I think there's some divinity in them for their commoners. And so that is very interesting to see how this operates in the since from after the conquest until now, when you don't have in power this royal families, but still the authority, you know, they have the word, they have the moral and ethical authority to negotiate and what they think about being in charge of the community. And I've been working since 8 months ago with my high Mixtec teacher, which is a student from Santa Maria Cuquila, who is doing her linguistic studies here in Mexico City.
Oh, wow.
And I'm only doing these interviews with the ancient authorities in Mixtec.
Wow.
So I have this beautiful discourses about being in charge of the community. And when I translate them with my teacher, I see this sacred discourses that we have in the 16th century grammar made by the Dominican friars, like, I don't know, Father Fray Antonio de los Reyes, you know, who was a vicario of Tepozcolula and who has a very beautiful Arte en la Lengua Mixteca that published in 1593. And he talks about a sacred discourse that was only known by the rulers and not by the commoners.
Right.
And you can see the
remnants.
The remnants, thank you, of this in the Mixtec discourses of the authorities.
Wow.
When they say in a lot of metaphors why and how and what it means to be in charge of the community. And it's beautiful because they say repeatedly that they are the hijas. And hija, it's a word that comes from the pre-Hispanic times and that is record by the friars who spoke Mixtec and published this beautiful vocabularies. And it means Lord.
Wow.
Señor.
And they still use it.
Rey, yes. And my Mixtec professor, she's only 22. She says, I don't know how to translate Illa. And I say, don't translate it.
It has no translation. Yeah.
We'll leave it because Illa, it's very important.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And we have it. And, you know, I've seen this because they remember, of course, they don't. They know they were. They had native rulers, and they talked of them. They, especially the old people, about them. They said that they could bring water. They could move rocks. They were powerful and things like that.
One of them blew up one of the mountains, right?
Yes, that's right.
I love that story.
and that they also could. Do many wonderful, you know, they protected the boundaries of the towns in their flying horses. That's what they
old
people say now. And the very interesting thing about this is that these rulers are mixed in the mythology because they were so very important. And they even remember the names of some of them that I have tracked in the archives that come from the 16th century.
Wow.
And also, once I was talking to an old peasant friend, well, not friend, because he's a very distinguished old man of the Cuquila town, but, well, as a student of him, I was talking to him. And I said, okay, so why these Hiyas had so many powers? And he said, well, because they have them. And I said, but why? And then I think he got tired, you know, because he said, this lady doesn't understand anything. And then he looked at me like, closing a little bit his eyes, and he said, well, you know, I don't know. The only thing I can tell you is that the Hiyas were not like you and me.
Wow.
And so, yeah, so this is what I want to study now. This Hiyas, and then how the local authorities inherited this power in some ways, and disrespect, and could unify the communities, and some of them survived through the 19th century and the 20th, and how they were negotiating with the national and with the colonial and national state until our days.
And what's going on right now? Is it going well, badly?
Oh, no, I have a lot of information, you know. Uh-huh. So, yes, I have a lot of...
Oh, I meant in Kukila.
Oh, well, how are they going?
How are they negotiating? Yeah.
Well, very good. They're doing their best. You know, they are working a lot to, well, this is...
Working on some new cultivars, right? Different kind of beans. Did I see that?
Yes. Yes. My sister-in-law, she's a biologist who works in biotechnology.
Wow.
And she has developed a bean resistant to drug because the land is very dry and it's been, you know, bad land since with almost no water. I believe even before the conquest, though they have this terrace system that after the conquest and it was, you know, broken and forgotten. But I think these beans can help them, and we are trying to get some funding to, you know, work with this because my sister-in-law has given them some seeds and an atelier or workshop about how to flow this bean. But she gave some samples, but we, for, I don't know, like 2 hectares. How do you say that?
Hectares?
Yes. But we need more. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to get some, you know, some institution to be interested in developing this with the help of my sister-in-law, mm-hmm. Professor Beatriz de Ruiz. And also I convinced the National Institute of Anthropology, where I work, where I am a researcher, to help with rebuilding the community museum with ecological and local materials.
Oh,
and
fabulous.
Also an artesania store for the artesanian things they sell, and also a restaurant and experimental field for their medicine plants.
Wow.
And I have all the project made by the young architect Daniel Filoy, who works at the architect faculty of the National University of Mexico, the UNAM. And we have everything ready. And I, you know, it helped me a lot. I have to say that last year I was invited as professor in the University of Harvard. It not only helped me to learn a lot of things and also to be in a wonderful environment for research, but it also helped me because I don't know if Harvard University knows this, but you know, it's very much admired. This
it is. They know. I think they know that,
right? Huh? And in Mexico also. So my authorities were very impressed when they gave David Rockefeller scholarship and also this invitation to give a seminar at the history department, which I'm very grateful for. At Harvard, and when they knew this and I came back, I have to take the chance of this, and I show them the project and they say, okay, we're in. And so I'm very grateful.
Good job. That is great.
So right now I'm negotiating that.
Oh, well, we'll keep our fingers crossed.
Okay, thank you, Jenny. Yeah.
We've been talking with Athalia Ruiz Medrano, the author of Mexico's Indigenous Communities, Their Lands and Histories from 1500 to 2010. Check out this book. It's fabulous. It's very exciting. And it's written as she talks. It's fabulous. Enjoy.